managing editor at townhall.com, and I am here today with...
Alex Seitzwald, political reporter for salon.com.
Good, great. Thanks for coming on with me, Alex. We're going to talk about a couple different issues of the day and some of the things that I really want to get a progressive's perspective on, because I haven't had the time recently to really sit down and kind of chat with a progressive to challenge my notions of some of the things that have been going on in the news. But so first off, let's say, you know, the media is kind of grouping all of these scandals, well, they'll call them scandals, together as one kind of narrative of malpractice in the federal government. Why don't you try to, or let's say, have you convince me of what is and what isn't a legitimate issue being raised in the media over the past 2 weeks?
Sure, and I'm happy to provide the token progressive voice. I think in all of these scandals, quote-unquote, you know, the Benghazi, IRS, the AP targeting, the targeting of the Fox News reporter by the Department of Justice, in all of them, there's a kernel of truth, of wrongdoing, of something that the American people would not be happy with their government doing. But what I don't see here is any kind of malicious intent or, you know, actual intentional wrongdoing. It's been compared to Watergate a lot, and I don't see anything like that. And I certainly don't see any kind of unified theory here. They have all been lumped together, but I think that's more a product of timing. They just happen to all come out at around the same time, whereas I don't see any evidence of White House involvement, of the president's involvement, or anything to suggest that these are really in any way related. You have different agencies in a massive bureaucracy that employs millions of people doing different things. And I think if they had come up at different times, I think of like the GSA scandal or other scandals that have arisen within agencies that have been confined to those agencies. So I have no problem with talking about these issues and talking about trying to find what went wrong and what could be done better here. But I have a problem with grouping them all together and suggesting that there's some kind of nefarious White House influence when there's so far, at least I haven't seen anything to suggest that that's true.
Right. I think we'll get to Eric Holder in a moment, but one of the things that I've raised is to the extent that, let's say that this is, as you're saying, it's a technocratic issue, it's a bureaucratic issue, and it's just about a giant bureaucracy where there's a lot of moving parts and a couple of people did a couple of things wrong.
Right.
Let's take the IRS issue. Isn't it kind of really bad for conservatives in the long run if it actually is just a bureaucratic issue, you know, that bureaucrats at the IRS were trying to look through some 501c4 applications, and the thing that comes to their mind is, we're going to group these by who says that they're affiliated with Tea Partiers, and we're going to look at those a lot harder. Now, even if it is, you know, some low-level and some mid-level bureaucrats, doesn't that reveal kind of the way that government bureaucrats think, in that they don't really see a problem with, targeting conservatives in that way?
Maybe, but I don't know. I haven't seen that yet. What I kind of think is going on here, and I don't know that this is necessarily true, but what seems like the most likely explanation that's going on here is you have this category of groups, 501c4s, which are supposed to be social welfare groups, and they're supposed to not be involved in politics. You can do a certain amount of politicking, but it's not supposed to be your primary mission, and that's been hazily defined, and I think that's what the whole problem is here, is that the IRS employees were actually trying to do their job and ferret out what was a legitimate social welfare group from what was a political group. And at the time that this was all going on, this was after Citizens United, as the Tea Party movement was ascendant, there was a ton of new groups being founded with Tea Party conservative ideals. So they said, hey, we're trying to figure out what are political groups. Here are a lot of seemingly political groups being started. Let's give them extra scrutiny and see if they're actual political groups instead of bona fide social welfare groups. I mean, the way they went about this is wrong, clearly. You know, I think this is a really clumsy mechanism to be looking for keywords like Tea Party or conservative. But if you're going to do that, you have to also look for, you know, progressive, liberal, whatever the alternative on the left side. Even that would not be ideal, but I think it would resolve a lot of the questions here. So, again, I don't see any kind of, like, targeting or intentional targeting of conservative groups. I don't see them going after conservative groups in any way. And remember, the only group that was actually denied 501c4 status was a progressive group, Emerge America, which was training Democratic female political politicians. So these groups are just being given extra scrutiny. The way they did it is wrong. But I think what they were trying to do is essentially create a workaround, because the IRS hasn't defined a better way to determine what's a political group, what's a social welfare group, and that's something that progressives have long been calling for. So it's a little bit ironic, I think, that you know, progressives tend to be more in favor of campaign finance reform, including putting up a stricter firewall between genuine social welfare groups that should get tax-exempt status and political groups that are kind of hijacking the tax system. And then they did this targeting improperly of conservative groups, and now, you know, everyone's freaking out about that. If we had followed the progressive argument of putting up a clear definition of what is a political group and what is not, maybe this would have all been avoided.
Yeah, I would say that that's certainly right, but that's an argument that has been being made for, you know, 10 or 15 years now, right, by progressives. By the standards that had been clearly set up for 501c4 groups, you know, since 1998, since 2000, for a long time now, a lot of these groups clearly fit, you know, the definition of what the IRS had been going by. So you had groups like Media Matters for America has a 501c4. A lot of progressive advocacy organizations have 501c4s. And those had all been approved over the past 10 years. Do you not see a problem in, you know, in 2010, the IRS goes, okay, well, this is the line, you know. All those other groups were fine, but now that there are Tea Party groups getting involved, now is when we need to crack down on this.
Yeah, no, I do see a problem with it, but I don't think it's, I don't think the thinking was now that Tea Party groups are getting involved. I don't know, but again, this is just my guessing what the most likely situation that occurred based on the information available. Because there was a objective fundamental change which raised the stakes tremendously for these groups, which was Citizens United, so which said that these groups can now spend unlimited amounts of money in electoral campaigns. So the stakes are suddenly much higher. And it just happens to coincide with a time that the Tea Party was ascendant and a lot of these groups are being created. Maybe, you know, if it was under the Bush administration when Citizens United came down, or some other time when there was a MoveOn.org or, you know, liberal groups were being created, maybe they would say, hey, a lot of liberal groups are being created that appear political, let's give them extra scrutiny. That seems to me what happened here. But personally, I say that, you know, I come down on the side of campaign finance reform and say that all of these groups should receive extra scrutiny. Media Matters, I used to work for the Center for American Progress Action Fund, which is a C4. I say they should be given more scrutiny. Everybody, left, right, center, anybody who's doing politics and using this section of the tax code should be given scrutiny, but the way that the IRS did it in singling out Tea Party groups was definitely wrong.
So in your estimation, this basically comes down to a coincidence of timing.
Yeah, and you know, trying coincidence of timing is part of it, and then a workaround of agents or executives, we don't really know exactly who, you know, trying to single out political groups, and this is in that moment what they saw as the only way to do it, which was clearly wrong. But I think the circumstances, the timing, were part of it. That's not all of it. I mean, I don't want to excuse the, you know, it was wrong for them to target these groups. But had it occurred at a different time, maybe they would have gone after liberal groups.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm not sure that I buy it's a coincidence of time. I do think that bureaucrats in general, people who go into government work, do tend to hold kind of more liberal beliefs than the median American voter, right? And so someone, you know, bureaucrats acting in this way, probably to them it doesn't strike them as so obviously wrong in the moment, right? But obviously, now that the media's got a hold of it, we're discussing it, we can say, you know, that was wrong, they shouldn't have done that. But I think that that does portend kind of a glum outlook for conservatives in kind of reigning in the bureaucracy, which is something that Republicans have been complaining about since, you know, the time of Richard Nixon, which, not to associate this with wrongdoing, but he famously complained about how it was impossible to get the federal bureaucracy under control.
Yeah, well, a couple of thoughts on that, or a few. You know, one is that, yes, I think there is plenty of evidence, and a lot of people have written, I think Tim Carney had a good piece about how a lot of the IRS employees here, you know, did donate to get Democrats. But on the other hand, there have been plenty of liberal groups that have been targeted by the IRS too. As I mentioned, the only group to be denied funding was a liberal group. Under the Bush administration, the NAACP got targeted for an audit by the IRS. A progressive church in California got targeted for an audit after the pastor there made some disparaging comments about the Iraq war. And Greenpeace also got targeted by an audit. So, you know, maybe politics are a factor here, but I think it's like low on a long list of things that are influencing people. And obviously, it's something to be aware of, but I haven't seen anything yet that suggests that that was the motivating factor here. Two, on that point about bureaucracy, I think if, you know, you have a whole political party that has for years trashed the bureaucracy as kind of terrible, you know, out of control, it might make people less interested in going into politics who are conservatives or Republicans, and it might make bureaucrats who are not particularly political side with the party that seems to be giving them more funding and isn't, you know, trashing them all the time. And a third point, which I think is maybe the most important one, I what Nixon said about reigning in the bureaucracy, I think is absolutely true. But if you talk to anyone, a political appointee in any administration, Democratic or Republican, that's true regardless. And I think political appointees often come in expecting to shake things up. They have a big agenda. And it turns out that they get there and they realize that it's really the bureaucrats who run these agencies, not the political appointees. And it has nothing to do with politics in the grand scheme, but in a much more granular kind of, you know, bureaucratic notion of people holding on to their turfs and not wanting some political appointee of either party coming in and telling them how to do their job. If you look at the IRS, it's an agency with over 100,000 employees, and two of them are political appointees. So the notion that, you know, these two guys who are the director and the chief counsel could, you know, manage to work the entire agency and filter down to run a message from the White House that they should be targeting Tea Party groups just seems really absurd to me. When you ask anybody who works in government, you know, to try to get their little agency or their little corner of some agency to do something, and often they get so much pressure from civil servant, bureaucratic civil servants, that they can't do it. And final point, you know, these political appointees have very little recourse when it comes to controlling bureaucrats because they're protected by civil service laws. You basically can't fire these people, so they really run these departments, and it's hard for anybody to control them.
Yeah, now that actually gets to, you know, a point that conservatives have made for a very long time, which is that civil service laws and government sector employee unions have made it really, really difficult to either discipline or dismiss or lay off, you know, misbehaving federal employees. I mean, bureaucrats at all levels, but federal employees in particular.
Sure.
So maybe we can get a compromise campaign finance reform / civil service reform law passed here, right?
Yeah, I like that. I think I'll get myself in trouble with labor unions here, but I tend to be pretty sympathetic to that view, probably less so than you are. You know, I would probably go a lot less far in reform, but I think there is definitely a lot of room for reform there. And in my interest, it would be in making government more efficient and, you know, operate more cleanly. And I think if you win an election and you come in and you install thousands of political appointees, you should have some control over what that agency does. And, you know, you really can't do that right now. So I would like to see some reform there for sure.
I mean, I think that it is important that the IRS is actually specifically more insulated from political pressure than a lot of the other agencies are. And I think that's important. But certainly, in general, there's a lot of room for reform there.
Right. And that's because of Nixon, we should mention, who's come up a lot in this debate.
Yes.
After he used the IRS to both go after enemies and defend friends, you know, Congress made it really very independent. As I said, you know, only two political appointees.
Right. Now, moving on, something that a lot of conservatives... So, for a long time, conservatives have been calling for Eric Holder's resignation. Based on two kind of scandal-ish things, because I don't want to just call everything a scandal, that happened in President Obama's first term. First, on the Operation Fast and Furious, and second on how the administration responded to Benghazi. And now that's kind of gotten a little more steam, at least in the media, with how the Justice Department has obtained phone records and email records and even physical location records of a couple different journalists.
Yeah.
If you now take away the appearance aspect of this, because in my opinion, I think it would do a lot for the appearances of the Obama administration right now if President Obama asked for Eric Holder's resignation. I think that would do wonders for at least his image in the media. But aside from that, if you're President Obama and you are evaluating Eric Holder on how he has performed his job over the last 5 years, do you ask for his resignation purely on the merits of his performance?
Well, it's a really good question, and it's hard to say. And I think you're right that lately there's been the calls have grown even on the left. I think the Huffington Post ran like a huge splash. You know, Eric Holder must go after the targeting of journalists, which to me is the most troubling of all of these scandals here, and speaks to something bigger, which I think we're going to get to later about civil liberties. But yeah, I mean, you know, I don't know if I have a really strong opinion on that. The Department of Justice does a lot of different things, and it's hard for me to say whether, you know, you look at the record alone and you decide whether Holder must go. I think there's strong arguments in both ways. But I will say if I was President Obama, I would not ask him to resign for pragmatic reasons than anything else. I just think it's going to be impossible to get a new attorney general confirmed through the Senate, you know, breaking a filibuster to get enough Republican votes, especially, or let alone someone nearly as liberal or who agrees with you as much as Eric Holder does. Eric Holder's, you know, a self-avowed progressive. He comes out of the civil rights division. You know, somebody who agrees closely with Obama on a lot of things. And so from a pragmatic point of view, I say you have to keep him just because you're never going to get anybody, or if you do get somebody, they're not going to be as progressive as Holder is.
That's definitely a good point. I hadn't thought about, obviously, President Obama's future difficulties in getting an attorney general confirmed. I mean, President Obama has been a fan of actually trying to reach across the aisle, get self-identified Republicans working in his administration. But a self-identified Republican attorney general, which would probably sail through easiest at this point, would be the highest profile, the most powerful cabinet member yet.
Yeah.
Who would be, you know, fairly largely removed from President Obama ideologically. I would say that you're absolutely right that he probably couldn't get someone who's going to agree with him, you know, on a base level like Eric Holder does, through the Senate at this point. And, you know, you're right pragmatically in that the Republicans would likely turn it into a show trial of really going after whoever comes up for nomination.
Absolutely.
So you might be right that weathering the storm is the best option for President Obama right now with Eric Holder.
Yeah, I mean, and not to mention, you know, just the narrative of if you fire your attorney general, you know, as you said, one of the most powerful cabinet members. I mean, you know, JFK put his brother in that position. It's really it's hard to overestimate the importance of the attorney general. And if Obama, you know, fired him or asked him to resign, suddenly that becomes this huge narrative and, you know, creates a lot of political problems in addition to the pragmatic ones for the president.
I mean, I would see, and, you know, I'm a conservative, I tend to think of the media as adversarial to conservatives. I do think that Eric Holder resigning would take a lot of media heat off of the administration. I think that he could justifiably say, you know, I was insulated from a lot of the missteps that Eric Holder made. I don't agree with them, and, you know, I'm holding Eric Holder accountable, and that's it. You know, zero tolerance from here on out. And I think that the media would really appreciate that, especially because, you know, the largest scandal, or the most important, maybe the most, the thing with the most policy implications is the phone record seizure of the Justice Department of journalists.
Yeah.
And President Obama could say, you know, this is too far. The media needs a little more a little more shield from the administration. This was an overreach by Eric Holder, and now he's gone. And probably segue into a push for a media shield law. Which, as far as media narrative, I feel would take a huge burden off of President Obama's shoulders right now.
Yeah, well, they did, as you, they did push for a media shield law, like, right away, which is a pretty naked attempt to, you know, calm the media narrative down. But I think in terms of that, he's missed the opportunity to do that if he was going to, and maybe there'll be another opportunity if new revelations emerge, which is entirely possible, you know, about other media organizations targeted or people going further. But right now, it seems like Holder is trying to, you know, have a second chance. He's doing all these off-the-record meetings with bureau chiefs and senior executives in media organizations. Well, they were going to be off the record, and then after complaints, they decided to put them on the record. So, right. And he gave the interview to the Daily Beast, or not, he didn't give an interview, but there were sources, leaks to the Daily Beast saying that he is personally remorseful about it. So, you know, whether you believe any of that or not, it's clearly an effort to kind of make nice and ask for a second chance, which I think is the right thing to do. It's, you know, it's not a dollar late too short or whatever that phrase is. Right. But, you know, but it is, if you're going to keep him, and it, by all accounts, you know, Obama came out really quickly and said, I have full confidence in the Attorney General, even as people like Harry Reid and senior Democrats were really trashing him. It would just be for Obama now to say, you know what, I can't stand for this. It would just be such a sudden reversal from everything else that he's been saying. I think the media would would pique their interest and would only cause even more of a feeding frenzy than has already been going on.
Right. And I do think that Holder doesn't seem like the type to go on his own, especially in light of the testimony, I think it was 2 weeks ago, where he scolded Daryl Issa. He said, you know, I don't get any respect when I come up to Congress. This, you know, this behavior is unacceptable, and I cannot believe that, like, you know, Daryl Issa is treating him like this. So I think that anything less than President Obama personally asking for Eric Holder's resignation is not going to be enough, and that he is going to weather the storm, come hell or Obama asking for his signature.
Yeah, I think that's totally right. And there was actually a book that came out maybe a year or two ago. I'm forgetting who wrote it now. Where they reported, I think it was a Newsweek guy, reported that Holder actually submitted his resignation or threatened to submit his resignation. And Obama personally talked him into, you know, staying on.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, this was during the Fast and Furious scandal, and because apparently Holder has a lot of enemies in the White House, and I mean you see leaks about this all the time. I think there was a story in Politico, either today or yesterday, which I completely believe. And it's a tough job, because you really do have a lot on your shoulders, and legally you're very isolated from the White House or other administration people. I mean, you actually can't talk to them on about a lot of stuff. So it's a really tough job, and it's always going to be political. I mean, just think about, you know, how Janet Reno or any of Bush's AGs were always vilified. It's really a tough job. So yeah, I think it would take Obama to, you know, really personally ask him to step down for Holder to leave. And I'll say that I think Republicans kind of jumped the gun on calling us for his resignation after Fast and Furious. So now everything seems kind of they've taken the weight out of the call now, and he can go up on the Hill and say that to Daryl Issa without really feeling impunity, because it's like, what are you going to do to me? You already called for my resignation. You already held me in contempt of Congress. There's really nothing left for you to do. I'm still here. You know, what else you got? Nothing.
Right. Yeah. Now, the kind of snooping on journalists has continued what a lot of people saw as troubling civil liberties policy from the Bush administration. And obviously this is about journalists rather than about American citizens, which is what the Bush administration kind of telecommunications liberties controversy was about. And President Obama had a speech last week in which he tried to kind of quiet this growing unrest about his civil liberties policies, and you know, whether or not the snooping on journalists is actually a part of President Obama's civil liberties policies or just an overreach by Eric Holder.
Yeah.
Do you buy the criticisms that have been made of the White House on civil liberties from both the left, obviously, and Republicans, some of the new wave-ish Republicans like Senator Rand Paul and Senator Mike Lee?
Yeah, almost entirely. I mean, I'm really sympathetic to those arguments and critical of the White House here. Especially when you consider that Obama largely won the Democratic primary against Hillary Clinton by being on the left on these kinds of issues. I mean, mainly the Iraq War, but the civil liberties and the war were tied up together, certainly like in a segment of the Democratic base that particularly cares about those issues. And in the Senate...
Certainly on Guantanamo as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And
I don't remember, was Hillary Clinton pro-closure of Guantanamo in the primaries? Because I feel like she might have been, if she was pro, then she was the least enthusiastic about it.
Yeah, I don't remember the exact details, but I think at that point pretty much every Democrat had come around to closing. But he certainly talked about it more and, you know, of course signed the executive order on his very first day in office to close it. So and he made that a big promise on the campaign trail. So yeah, I mean I think it's definitely there's a lot of room to be critical here of the president, and you know, in terms of leaks, he's prosecuted twice as many leaks as have been prosecuted in the entire history of the U.S. government before that, not just the Bush administration.
Yeah.
Drones, of course, have been, you know, a huge uptick on there. You know, there's some nuance here, of course. It's, I think, an effective anti-terrorism policy, and we decided that we don't, and correctly, that we don't like Guantanamo, we don't like black sites and renditions, and so when you can't capture terrorists, or when it becomes harder to capture or suspected terrorists, you know, one of the only policy options left is to kill them. At least that's what the administration would say. And then, you know, the NSA is building a huge facility out in Utah to monitor everybody's telephone and email calls, which supposedly will not affect Americans. But basically what they've done... Oh, and in December, they pushed back through the FISA Amendment Act without almost any debate, which basically there was, you know, the New York Times reported the Bush administration was snooping on American citizens with NSA wiretaps illegally, and that was a huge scandal, rightly so. But then Congress essentially passed a law to legalize it. So Obama is doing a lot of the same things that Bush did, but inside the legal framework. So I guess that's better. You know, I
guess it was right. And the Republican cynical response on his, you know, clarification of drone policy was, oh, you trust yourself to use drones. You just don't trust the next guy. So you're just trying to get these rules in place so that, you know, when you're gone, someone else has to follow the rules, but you didn't have to follow the rules.
Yeah. And I think there's probably some truth there. And I think that's also probably the reason that you hear a lot less on civil liberties from liberals than you did. I mean, this was the issue in 2006, 2007, in the Democratic wave that came in 2006. This was one of the top things that everyone was talking about and the biggest oppositions to the Bush administration. And then Obama comes in and suddenly you hear almost nothing about it from the left. And I think that's really too bad. But I think it's exactly what you just said. You know, they didn't trust Bush to be snooping on their calls, but they trust Obama to, which is ridiculous, of course. But that's kind of the perception. And yeah, right. As for the speech, it sounded very good. It's just a question of whether it actually gets implemented. And given the record that we have, there's not a whole lot of benefit of the doubt to be given. He hasn't really earned it. So I think we have to be, you know, cautious and wait and see what actually happens.
Now, here's a question on Republicans and let's say opportunism. Do you think that, let's say, Senator Rand Paul truly does care about Abdulrahman al-Awlaki, who was killed in a drone strike, and there was no reason given? There were no other, I think, military value targets in that drone strike, and he wasn't actually a military value target other than the fact that he was the son of Anwar al-Awlaki, who was a target.
Right.
Do you think that Republicans actually care about this issue? I mean, let's say Rand Paul, who, let's say we have the best faith possible about a Republican on civil liberties, it's going to be Rand Paul.
Yeah.
Do you think that he does genuinely care about this issue, or do you think that he's kind of cynically hitting the White House on this?
I'll give the cop-out answer, which I think is true, which is both. I think he does care about this. But on the other hand, if you go back and look at his record, he's said a lot of troubling things on civil liberties himself. During the campaign, he called for doubling the size of Guantanamo, and then the statement was kind of disappeared down the internet memory hole, you know, after he won. In a radio interview, he said that the U.S. should be tracking every foreign student from the Middle East, you know, foreign exchange student from the Middle East. And there's others that I don't recall off the top of my head. So, yeah, and whether those statements were opportunistic to appeal to, you know, Kentucky voters who might be uncomfortable, I don't know, but it's certainly...
Right, kind of primary Republican voters in Kentucky.
Right, and he was, I would imagine, he was certainly vulnerable on those kinds of issues. I don't know, it's really hard to say, which leads me to the conclusion that Rand Paul is far less idealistic than his father or than a lot of people give him credit for, and he's much more of a political operator in one way or the other. You know, whether he's being opportunistic and being a civil liberties kind of crusader, or on the other stuff he said that conflicts with that, I don't know. But either way, it suggests that he's not, as ideological and as pure as he'd like people to believe. And then beyond him, I mean, there's just some ludicrous stuff. Like when he did the filibuster and Mitch McConnell came down to the floor to protest drone policies, it's just like...
And Marco Rubio came down to join at one point as well.
Right, right. And, you know, just come on now. That's absolutely insane. I think that's definitely opportunistic and pretty obviously so. You know, but by the same token, you could probably say a lot of Democrats' opposition to Bush on those issues was similar, but I think... that there's probably more, it's certainly wider spread within the Democratic Party than the Republican Party, you know, what I would characterize as a good stance on civil liberties.
Right. I would say when it comes to kind of national intelligence and military security, Republicans buy the just trust the government argument generally more than Democrats would, or
yeah,
let's say conservatives do generally more than progressives do. And
Which is ironic, because that's the opposite on every other issue when it comes to the government. But.
Right, exactly. On every other issue, it's... Well, you could say... my explanation is just that, you know, conservatives say that national defense is, you know, a legitimate function of the federal government.
Right.
And so, you know, on issues that conservatives do think are legitimate functions of the federal government, they tend to assign a lot more leeway to what the federal government does. I would say... I would hope that the Obama administration's record on civil liberties does awaken a more libertarian instinct in kind of base-level conservatives, because they're seeing now what happens when a guy they really don't trust is pulling those reins of power that they were so ready to trust President Bush with.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's going to be the case. You know, I don't know if... you know, we had a president, Mitt Romney, right now, that conservatives wouldn't be like, oh yeah, we trust Mitt Romney. He can have these powers. Just we don't want Democrats to have these powers.
Yeah, and part of me doesn't really care whether it's opportunistic or not, as long as somebody is talking about these issues, which
right.
would otherwise not be talked about in Washington. I think is important. I will say that I'm a little disappointed that Republicans, you know, of these three scandals that we've been talking about, the ones that Republicans are talking about most are Benghazi, which I think is we've already chewed over, you know, that we're done with that in terms of, as far as I see it at least, and the IRS, where there's some more to be learned. And they've largely ignored so far the targeting of journalists, which is really unfortunate, I think, and too bad, because that is, to me, the biggest scandal and the one where there is... You know, that speaks to a policy that the administration has, that the Department of Justice has. That wasn't an error. That wasn't rogue agents. That was the Attorney General of the United States okaying warrants. That's a real fundamental problem, and that's one that's getting the least attention. You know, and part of that is because they were the ones calling for investigations of the leaks themselves. So I guess I'll give them credit for not being hypocritical on that. But it's just too bad, because I kind of thought there was a moment where... civil liberties and these issues, press freedom, would really be the top line, you know, major debate in Congress. And it seems like we're talking about the IRS more than that.
Right. I mean, I think that the IRS issue is probably a little larger than you're giving it credit for. But I do think that you're right. The problem with the phone records scandal is that it was done by the Obama administration, so you can say that the portion of progressives who are Obama apologists and Obama sycophants don't want to touch that issue at all.
Right.
And the Republicans tend to think that... I mean, I do think that there's a little bit of a conservative mindset that, well, if you're not doing anything wrong, what do you have to worry about the government snooping you on? Which I think is a really bad impulse for people to have, but I definitely have talked to conservatives who have that impulse. But yeah, I don't think that's something that hits like a conservative base value, like the IRS scandal. Certainly, the IRS. You know, if the White House had involvement in the IRS investigations. That is like a scandal cooked up to hit Republicans exactly, you know, where their base values lie.
Right.
Whereas the phone records of journalists is not really, you know, their conservatives are generally hostile to the mainstream media anyway. It hits them a little bit harder because there were Fox News journalists involved, so they do care about that. If you want to call them cynical, but yeah, it does. It seems like there's certainly more fertile legal ground to go after Eric Holder and the Justice Department on that, and they just have not taken the advantage so far.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's definitely right. And it's actually, you know, you could kind of say crassly that it's good that it was a Fox News journalist that was targeted by the Department of Justice, because I think it did get more play on the Republican side, conservative side, than if it had been a New York Times journalist or something like that. I mean, I'm being a little facetious there, but I think you know what I mean.
Right, yeah. All right, now the last topic I wanted to get to is last week, kind of in the blogosphere, a kind of discussion burst forth after I think it was spurred originally by a Jonathan Chait profile of Josh Barrow, who's now with Business Insider, on conservatives and Republicans who are trying to change the conservative movement from the inside. And it was kind of lit into a brush fire by Paul Krugman, who basically said, no, these people are, they're conservatives at heart, and that means that they're wrong on a base number of issues, and there's really no point in engaging with them. Do you see, in the wake of the 2012 elections to now, do you think that as an outsider looking in, there's been an honest, or at least in your opinion, honest enough level of introspection on the conservative movement side?
I would say yes, but it's, there has been an honest look, but I wouldn't say it's everyone on the conservative movement side. And I think what the post-election discussion has really exposed, well, something that we already knew, but has shown an even greater relief, is that there are just huge divisions right now within the conservative movement. And, of course, you know, there are huge divisions within the progressive movement, but I think we're at a moment right now where the right is more fractured than the left. And so you have things like the RNC autopsy report, or the report that just came out today from the College Republicans, which are pretty candid. And, you know, I was impressed with both of their willingness to take on, you know, major core fundamental issues on gay marriage and immigration. And even the College Republican report take on economic issues, which is the real bedrock core pillar of conservatism and the Republican Party. So there have been honest looks, and somebody like Josh Barrow, or Liz Mayer, or, you know, plenty of other people on the conservative side who have taken honest, hard looks. But the question is implementation, you know, whether those looks will actually get turned into anything. And so far, I really haven't seen that. I mean, you know, there was a big test on immigration reform, whether it would kind of devolve into the same way that it did under Bush, with the right, you know, making so much hay and noise that it falls apart. And at first it looked like that wasn't going to happen, and now I think that's a very real possibility. So it might take another major electoral loss for all Republicans to really get the message. I mean, you have this small group of reformers, but I think at the moment, at least from the outside, it looks like they're still in the minority, even if they're in the leadership. You know, even if you have the RNC chairman, it's still they're kind of dragging the base along with them.
Right, and you see, I think that more in the conservative movement, and maybe I'm wrong on this, but in the conservative movement, you see such a look down your nose at Beltway conservatives or Beltway Republicans. So I think that maybe in the Republican Party, it's harder for you know, the elite opinion makers to kind of change direction of a larger movement. Because you have people, you know, in the heartland and in quote unquote real America, saying, you know, these are just East Coast elitists. They're trying to tell us how to live our lives and what to care about, and go along with their plans that we don't really like. I think we'll see what kind of traction we get. I would say, you know, an article from The Onion actually resonated with me very heavily, even to today, during the 2004 election, and it was John Kerry unveils one-point plan for America, and the one-point plan is get rid of President Bush. And I think that is actually a really good kind of corollary for where the Republican Party has been over the past 1 or 2 years, right? It's not we have a plan for America, it's get rid of Barack Obama,
right?
Then we'll tell you the plan for America. So I don't necessarily think, and I'm not an electoral expert, and I am really far from what you should consider a median Republican voter, especially Republican primary voter, So I don't know. I wouldn't pretend to know what wins elections. But I do think that the circumstances aren't as dire as you know, the national media wants to make them out to be. I do think you might see a new agenda, not a new agenda, a refurbished agenda, an agenda with a new paint job on it, from Republicans fairly soon. And I certainly don't think that, you know, passing immigration reform and then slapping a "we solved the demographic problem" sticker on it is going to fix anything. That the Republican demographic problem is a lot deeper than that. But I think that we've seen a lot more introspection now than like we saw in 2008. 2008, the autopsy report was basically John McCain was too liberal.
Yeah.
That's it. You know, we needed to run someone more conservative. And in 2008, Romney was the conservative alternative.
Right.
So right now you still have people saying, well, Romney wasn't a real conservative. We needed to run someone really conservative. But I think that there are legitimately a lot of people who said, all right, well, that didn't work. Something does need to change if Republicans are going to be a national electoral force in the future. And I do think, you know, Josh Barrow is very valuable, even when he's very acerbic at times. And a lot of the reformist writers, Yuval Levin, Ross Douthat, Raihan Salam, people like that, I think that you're seeing them certainly at least get traction with the DC elite. Now, whether that carries out to the conservative movement at large is another question. But you know, I'm hopeful, fingers crossed, because I do think that a different kind of agenda outside of you know, tax cuts and deregulation is what's needed to win in the future. Although I do think that tax cuts and deregulation are often good policy, that can't necessarily be your kind of go-to move.
Yeah, and a couple of thoughts. I agree with a lot of that. I think it's hard when one of like the core, you know, it's hard to move any movement. A movement is often grassroots, or it claims to be, and there's lots of people. But I think it's especially hard for the conservative movement, which is so fundamental. You know, one of the core principles is being anti-Washington, being real America, as you said. So it's kind of coming back to bite them that, you know, all these people who have played into the anti-Washington agenda sitting in Washington are now trying to tell people in real America, you know, how to think about gay marriage or immigration or whatever it might be.
Yeah, like Karl Rove, for instance.
Right, exactly.
Who drove the real America elections of Bush is now saying, well, we need to change everything. That's not working.
Yeah, exactly. It's a little bit of just desserts, and that he's now become this villain, you know, on the Tea Party kind of right. But, you know, to kind of agree with Krugman here, I think a core problem on gay marriage and immigration, the social issues. I mean, I think abortion doesn't change at all because the polling isn't there, and it's a moral, you know, religious choice. There's not going to be new.
That's an unanswerable question.
Right. Exactly.
When does life begin?
Exactly. And there's not going to be any new information, or maybe there'll be some on the margins, but it's not like, you know, gay marriage where you can see a couple that's a same-sex couple that's married, and you're like, oh, that's not so scary, you know.
Well, you can see a couple that's married and happy and raises functional children, you know?
Yeah, right, exactly, and as it grows in acceptance. So I think abortion doesn't change, but on, you know, there's kind of this broad consensus that on these other issues they have to change. But then, you know, what does that leave? And that leaves the economic issues. And that's where I see real trouble, and if I were a conservative, I'd be really worried about it. If you look at the polls, you know, people want to raise taxes on the wealthy. They like regulation in some cases. They like, you know, labor regulations, environmental regulations, health and safety stuff. They like spending on infrastructure. So, you know, that's really, I think, where you have to kind of be a little bit queasy. And as you said, you can't just be anti-regulation, anti-taxes on everything all the time. But it's obviously harder to sell a message that's, well, you know, cut taxes most cases, but not all cases, and cut regulations in some cases, instead of just full out all the time, you know, 2 points, very simple. And because it's so core to the Republican message, you know, I think that's going to be a really hard thing to change or even talk about. And so far, all the most of the talk has been around these social issues, which are a little bit easier because they're a little bit more peripheral to the core vision.
Right. What I think that I've seen in the criticisms of the conservative reform movement is that there's kind of this foundational progressive narrative now, I think, that the financial crisis of 2008 changed everything. And, you know, the pre-2008 consensus of business cycle theory and the Federal Reserve's involvement and fiscal policy's counter-cyclical involvement needs to be thrown out the window now. And unless conservatives and Republicans can accept that all of that is wrong and that we do need a more active federal government in business cycle and macroeconomic policy, then, you know, the conservative movement is still intellectually bankrupt, which I think that a lot of conservatives have evolved fairly... fairly comprehensive fairly comprehensive criticisms of that reaction to 2008, and convincing reactions to that narrative of 2008. So I'm not sure, and that seems to be the kind of Paul Krugman, the dividing line of where that is that if 2008 didn't turn you into a Keynesian, then you are in denial, you know? And I think that the Krugmans of the world will never be happy unless that changes. What I'm interested in are progressives, I think, not of the Krugman mold, but more at the margins, who will say, okay, well, yeah, there are these issues that the Republican Party can change on and be an acceptable opposition party to my preferred party. But I'm not sure that there's ever going to be that kind of progressive elite who accepts that, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I think it kind of gets to a really fundamental question, which is, you know, why even have an opposition party? If you're a progressive, do you just want progressive Democrats to have, you know, 90 seats in the Senate and control everything? Or is it actually good to have an opposition party? And I think it is, without question, and I would prefer a better opposition party to the one we have now. Yeah, and I mean, I agree with Krugman on the policy. Like, I think the stimulus was right. I think it should have been bigger. I think the Federal Reserve should be doing more counter-cyclical action to stimulate employment. I think, you know, we should be spending a lot on infrastructure and stuff while interest rates are really low, and that the deficit and debt problems are real, but that they're not something to deal with right away, and that certainly austerity would be the worst thing we could do at the moment. But I don't have a problem, and I actually kind of appreciate people arguing the opposite on the other side, because we're not always going to be right. And you can't... Public policy is about finding the right balance, because there's always going to be, no matter what you do, there's always going to be unintended consequences and... problem. So you can never go full out in one direction. You have to kind of find the right balance, you know. And if you raise taxes too much, you will hurt employment. If you raise regulation too much, it will be bad for business. So you have to find that right balance, and I think that comes out in a healthy debate between the two parties. What I don't like is the kind of detachment from reality and lack of good faith that I see from a lot of Republicans in Congress, where we can't have an argument about, oh, the stimulus is too big, because it might raise interest rates and inflation in the future. It's like out of control socialist agenda trying to control your life, and Obamacare is going to kill you and push, you know, granny through the death panels and everything. So obviously demagoguery happens on both sides all the time, but I think it's a little bit worse on the right, and it obstructs, you know, a healthy debate on these issues, and so it leads people like Krugman to say, well, just, you know, we don't have any value in Republicans at all.
I would agree demagoguery happens on both sides. I wouldn't say it could be the case that it happens more often on the Republican side. But I don't think that that's a good reason to say burn it all to the ground. So I think, you know, I'm not prepared to evaluate who's worse, and I think that that's not a really productive discussion. And this is one of the things that really bugs me about Paul Krugman, is that he explicitly says, you know, I'm not going to try to argue against the best points my opponents make. And what often that means is that he's arguing against the worst points that his opponents make, which I think is pretty detrimental to our public debate. So, you know, Paul Krugman would rather argue against Eric Cantor than he would against, you know, Jim Manzi or Scott Sumner or some other Krugman equivalent on the right.
Yeah, but how much power does Eric Cantor have versus Manzi? Or, you know, I think it's, if he was arguing against, you know, I don't know, Orly Tates or something, then there's obviously no merit there. But Eric Cantor is...
No, I haven't looked into his archives, but I wouldn't be surprised if he argued against Orly Tates at some point.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, I get your point, and I guess you should be doing both. I mean, as the intellectual elite on the left, you know, Pulitzer Prize winner, he should be going after the best. But by the same token, he's become more than that kind of intellectual elite figure. He's, you know, a columnist now, almost more than an economist, and that means going after the predominant public narratives that are, you know, on your other side. And Eric Cantor is the number two House Republican. Like, he's a very influential person, and I think it's fair to go after his arguments because he has real, you know, he's pulling the strings.
Certainly, but so that's you're absolutely right. He's a columnist. He watches the news. Eric Cantor is important. Getting Paul Krugman's opinion on Eric Cantor is important. But I think that the jump that he then makes is, because Eric Cantor says this, none of my opponents can be trusted. You know?
Sure.
He says Eric Cantor speaks for everybody, so you can dismiss these other guys who are smarter and making better arguments because Eric Cantor's a crazy person.
Sure, sure. But, you know, everybody does that. I think, like, you know, Democrats are going to be running against Michael Bloomberg on gun control, even though Michael Bloomberg is not a Democrat, or they're going to be running against, you know, I don't know. I mean, that's a, you know, just kind of age old politics, right? You take the worst. Democrats do it with Michelle Bachmann or
right,
you know,
right.
Yeah.
I love the MSNBC epitaph for Michelle Bachmann last week. It was like nonstop Michelle Bachmann has retired, wall-to-wall coverage. Anyway, I think that's just about all the time we have for today. Thanks for coming on with me and being a good sparring partner.
Thanks, I really appreciate it.
Great, all right. Hopefully we'll do this again sometime.
Yeah, this was fun. Thanks again.
Thanks a lot.